every decision you will make today, from giving in to an old craving to just snapping at a coworker because you're stressed, is decided in a fraction of a millisecond.
Yeah, way before your conscious brain even knows what's happening.
Right. A deep-seated habit loop has already taken the wheel. But what if you could pause time right in that tiny, imperceptible window?
Which is such a wild concept, catching the compulsion before it ever becomes an action.
Exactly. And that is the mission of today's deep dive into the Raft to Freedom program.
It's a radical shift, really, in how we approach unhelpful patterns.
Yeah, because usually we wait until a compulsion is just running rampant, right?
Mm.
And then we try to fight it with sheer willpower.
Which almost never works and is just exhausting. This approach flips that dynamic entirely, looking at how to catch the spark before it hits the powder keg.
And to do that, we are looking at a very specific architecture today. It's the RAFT framework.
Right. And just to clarify, RAFT is an acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feeling, Train.
So the RAFT program uses this four-stage structure to help us navigate away from those old heavy loops of compulsion and steer toward a much more intentional way of living.
And for this deep dive, we are looking closely at Chapter 55 of the program, which is titled Our Lens on the World.
And this material sits securely in the final stage, right? The train stage.
Exactly. To give you some brief context, earlier in the RAFT journey, during the feeling stage, we learned how to find a tiny, quiet pause when reactivity stops.
But the train stage is where the active work happens.
Yeah, it is where we learn how to actively steer our attention outward from that still point.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the foundational premise of this chapter completely reframed how I think about habit loops.
How so?
Well, if we are trying to change deep-seated psychological patterns, why does this chapter spend so much time focusing on our physical senses? I mean, it seems a bit disconnected at first.
I know, it does. But it really comes down to how we process reality. Like, we tend to think of our experience as one massive, unmanageable monolith called my life or my stress.
Yeah, and when you view it that way, changing a habit feels impossible because the problem just feels way too big.
Right. But according to the texts, experience doesn't actually arrive as a monolith. It arrives channel by channel, input by input.
So understanding how to manage these specific sensory channels is like the mechanical secret to intercepting a compulsion.
Absolutely. Which brings us to breaking it down into those individual channels.
Yeah, the first major concept of the text, which is the sixth sense doors. This is an ancient upgrade to how we categorize perception, originally taught by Gautama, the Buddha.
Yeah, because most of us were taught that we have five basic senses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching.
But Gautama added a crucial sixth door.
Right, and that sixth door is thinking.
Which is huge. The framework treats the mind itself as a sense organ, fundamentally no different from the ear or the eye.
Gautama actually stated, "I will teach you the all." And he went on to list the eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, the body and tangibles, and the mind and mind objects.
He was basically pointing out that absolutely nothing in your subjective life, no problem, no joy, no overwhelming craving exists outside of these six specific inputs.
Yeah. And treating the mind as just another sense door completely changes the power dynamic.
It really does. Normally, when a thought pops into my head, especially a loud thought saying, I need to engage in this habit right now, I treat it like an emergency mandate from upper management.
Like you have to obey it immediately.
Exactly. I assume that because I thought it must be the absolute truth. But this framework suggests thoughts are just mental events passing through.
It takes the authority away from the thought. I mean, a thought of craving or a thought of deep anxiety can be observed in the exact same passive way that you observe the sound of a siren passing your window.
Right. You don't dive out the window to chase the siren down the street.
Exactly. Yet we habitually jump into our thoughts and chase them until we're totally exhausted.
Which brings up what the RAFT program calls the pinball effect.
Oh, yeah. Such a great analogy.
Right. If we aren't trained to see thoughts and senses as passing events, we just bounce helplessly between them.
Like a sight strikes the eye. Maybe you see a specific location tied to an old habit, and you bounce straight into a physical feeling of craving.
Then a thought strikes the mind, like a justification for why you should give in, and you bounce straight into the action.
You basically become a passive object in your own mind. You are at the total mercy of whatever stimulus hits the flippers next.
It feels like being strapped into an automated factory assembly line, where every single item on the belt demands you assemble it immediately, and the belt is moving way too fast.
It's so overwhelming.
So if that reactive pinball state is our default, How do we physically stop the assembly line before a habit actually gets built?
Well, the mechanism of change relies on learning to insert a deliberate pause. The raft program uses the metaphor of a ship, the raft itself, and introduces a concept called the clean handover on the bridge.
Right, because in a state of compulsion, a sensory visitor, like a highly stressful text message, just storms onto the bridge of the ship and shoves you away from the steering wheel.
But with training, we establish a gatekeeper. The gatekeeper stands at the door to the bridge and registers the incoming data.
Like saying we have visual input or we have a thought.
Exactly. And crucially, the gatekeeper does not automatically hand over the controls of the ship. Instead, they check the visitor's feeling tone.
Right. They ask, is this input pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral?
Yes. And with that one tiny procedural check, you break the chain reaction. What's fascinating here is how this ancient concept maps directly onto modern neuroscience.
Oh, I love this part. Tell them about the salience network.
So in the human brain, we have a network called the salience network, which relies heavily on a region known as the anterior insula.
And what does the anterior insula actually do in the context of a habit?
Think of it as the brain's threat detection siren. Its entire job is to tag cues in our environment as either urgent or ignorable.
But in a state of compulsion, this priority system gets deeply compromised, right?
Completely. Ordinary cues tied to old habits are suddenly tagged by the anterior insula as life or death urgent.
So it blasts the siren, flooding your system with adrenaline and grabbing your attention long before your logical, reflective brain even has a chance to power up.
Exactly. Your brain is literally blasting a five-alarm siren when the stimulus is just like a picture of a certain food or a mildly annoying email.
That is wild.
That's the mechanical reality of it.
Yep.
But by practicing mindfulness right at the sense doors, by having that gatekeeper simply name the channel and check the tone, you're actively engaging the prefrontal cortex.
Which is called top-down regulation, right?
Yes. You are using the logical thinking part of the brain to send a message back down to the emotional center saying, false alarm, stand down.
And over time, this deliberate pause actually restructures how those neural networks communicate. It weakens that automatic cue reactivity.
It really brings a whole new level of gravity to the idea of a pause.
It does. And in behavioral psychology, there's a parallel concept regarding how cues function, correct?
There is, yeah. In behavioral psychology, these sense doors act as what we call discriminative stimuli.
Meaning they are the specific environmental or internal cues that signal to your brain, the conditions are right. This is the situation where we execute the habit loop.
Exactly. And those cues are notoriously durable. That's why an old urge can suddenly reactivate out of nowhere.
It feels like a personal failure, but it's really just an ingrained response to a discriminative stimulus.
Right. So pausing at the sense door functions as a form of internal stimulus control.
It's like the difference between trying to stop a moving freight train by standing on the tracks and pushing against it versus just calmly walking into the rail yard and flipping a switch before the train even builds steam.
That's a great way to put it.
But knowing we need to flip the switch is one thing. How do we actually do it in the heat of the moment when the siren is going off?
Well, the RAFT program doesn't leave us hanging with just the theory. It provides a highly practical 6-step sequence to use as a workbench right at the point of contact.
Okay, let's go through them. The first move in the sequence is to name the door.
Right. When you notice you've been hooked by an urge or strong reaction, you quietly note the channel, like seeing, hearing, or thinking.
It sounds almost too simplistic, honestly.
It does, but mechanically, putting a linguistic label on the experience forces your brain to move out of the emotional processing center and into the language centers.
Oh, wow. So it shifts you from being lost inside the feeling to observing it from a slight distance.
Exactly. And the second step is to name the tone. You check if the feeling tone of that specific contact is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral.
Now, I have to push back on this a bit. Categorizing something as pleasant or unpleasant makes total sense because those are powerful driving forces. But neutral.
You're not a fan of neutral.
Well, isn't neutral just the boring waiting room before the next crisis hits? Like, why should we care about a neutral tone?
That assumption is exactly why compulsions hold so much power over us, actually. We are deeply conditioned to relentlessly chase pleasant sensations and fiercely run away from unpleasant ones.
And in doing so, we completely ignore the neutral.
Right. But if you look closely, a vast majority of our day is actually neutral. It's ordinary, middling, nothing special.
So what is the mechanical advantage of focusing on that?
It gives the nervous system a place to unclench. I mean, a compulsion or a craving is fundamentally an argument with reality.
It's a desperate demand for things to be different right now.
Yes. But a compulsion has absolutely nothing to argue with in a neutral space. When you train your brain to recognize and actually rest in a neutral tone, you starve the old loop of the friction it needs to survive.
Wow. A craving has nothing to argue with in a neutral space. That is incredibly potent. Which leads us to step three, make space.
Right. And the text points out that this doesn't require sitting down for an hour of formal meditation.
It can literally be a single breath, right?
Yeah, or consciously unclenching your jaw, or feeling the physical weight of your feet on the floor. You are just giving the physiological system a micro moment to downshift.
But making space isn't quite enough if your brain is still completely fixated on the object of your craving. You have to actively break that fixation.
Which is why step four is to let attention widen.
And why does widening our attention matter so much in that specific moment?
It's because of how our nervous system is wired to our visual and mental focus. When we get hooked by a strong craving or stressor, our field of awareness literally narrows into tunnel vision.
So our eyes focus sharply on one point, which sends a biological signal to the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight center, that we are in a high-stakes survival situation.
Exactly. So by intentionally widening our gaze, like taking in the periphery of the room or expanding our mental awareness to include sounds and bodily sensations, we are mechanically hacking that system.
We are manually triggering the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the rest and digest network.
Right. We are sending a physiological, all-clear signal to the brain, which chemically downregulates the stress response.
Okay, so once that system is downregulated, step five is to borrow support.
Yeah, the framework suggests that if your mind feels sluggish or dull, you borrow a bit of curiosity to wake it up.
And conversely, if you feel totally spun up, hot, and agitated, you lean heavily into settling and steadying yourself.
Exactly. And from that steadier balance place, we reach the final move, step six. Take a workable step.
And this isn't about making a grand life-altering resolution, is it?
Not at all. It is about choosing one small, immediate action that reduces harm in the present moment.
Right. Like, it might just be deciding to get a glass of cold water. It might be doing a quick stretch.
Or it could simply be doing absolutely nothing for three more breaths while you let the wave of the urge peak and wash over you.
So those six steps, name the door, name the tone, make space, widen attention, borrow support, and take a workable step. They basically turn an overwhelming crisis into a manageable mechanical sequence.
They break the monolith of experience back down into manageable channels.
And the RAF program offers some brilliant specific tactics for handling different sense doors when you're out in the real world. Like the breakdown on the smell door was fascinating to me.
Oh yeah, smell is such a powerful trigger.
It acts as a literal time machine in the brain. One specific scent can instantly transport you back a decade, dropping you right into the heart of an old destructive pattern.
And the tactic they suggest is immediate physical grounding. The moment you register the scent, you force your attention to the feeling of your feet on the floor.
You name the tone, and you consciously decide whether you need to physically step away from the environment to break the discriminative stimulus.
You don't just endure the trigger, you manage the door.
Exactly. But here's where it gets really interesting for me. The specific tactic for the thinking door.
What stood out to you there?
Well, if a sticky, aggressive thought pops up demanding that I engage in a habit, the program suggests we can gently test the thought's validity. Like, we can ask ourselves, did I order this thought from a menu? Can I make it vanish on command?
And what happens when you actually test it?
The answer is almost always no. I certainly didn't order the craving, and no matter how hard I try, I can't dismiss it on command.
Which is a huge realization.
It is, because it proves mathematically that the thought is not a decree from a boss inside my head. It's just a conditioned event passing through the weather system of my mind.
And the moment you realize you don't own the thought, its grip on you loosens significantly.
Yes, exactly.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's remarkable how ancient philosophers were utilizing this exact same cognitive mechanism millennia before we had functional MRI machines.
Really? Like who?
Well, the Stoics, for example. Thinkers like Epictetus were incredibly dialed into this idea of the sense of doors. They taught that an impression arrives through perception.
Right, so that is the initial contact at the door. It is unavoidable.
Yeah, you can't stop the sight of the object or the initial thought from popping up. But the Stoics argued that our distress, or our compulsion to act, depends entirely on the assent we give that impression.
Meaning it depends on our secondary judgment of the data.
Exactly. Which ties perfectly to Epictetus's famous idea that we are troubled less by events than by the views we take of them.
Oh, wow. So the crucial battleground is that split second right after contact, before the narrative hardens into absolute truth.
Yes. And the Pyrrhonian skeptics in ancient Greece took it even further. They practiced something called epiche, which translates to a deliberate suspension of judgment.
So by simply refusing to immediately label an impression as good or bad, by holding it in a state of neutrality, they cultivated profound mental calm.
The ancient takeaway that we are still applying today is profound in its simplicity. Perception simply delivers an appearance.
What happens next is interpretation.
And interpretation is the exact moment where your freedom enters the equation.
So what does this all mean? For you listening right now, it means you do not have to fight these massive, exhausting, white-knuckle battles against your unhelpful patterns.
You don't have to try and muscle your way through your own life.
You simply need to catch the moment of contact at the sense door. You find that tiny, still point, that mechanical pause, and you choose the next workable step. There's a brilliant quote in the text from the neuroscientist Anil Seth.
Oh, I know the one. He points out, our conscious experiences are kinds of controlled hallucinations.
It perfectly encapsulates the reality that what we perceive at our sense doors is just raw data, deeply colored by our past conditioning.
It is rarely the absolute, unquestionable reality we assume it to be. The texts even reference an ancient teaching called the Bahya Sutta, which provides perhaps the ultimate shorthand instruction for this entire framework.
In the scene, only the scene.
Right. When you look at an object, just let it be a visual form. Refuse to add a massive, heavy story about craving, identity, and the past onto it.
Just data passing through the door. I really want to emphasize that this incredible deep dive is based entirely on the RAFT to Freedom workbook, which was written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And what is truly staggering is that they are making the entire 66-chapter RAFT program freely available online under a Creative Commons license.
Yes. You can dive into all of this material at no cost by visiting RAFT2Freedom.org. It is a remarkable resource for anyone looking to understand their own mind.
It really is. And as we wrap up our exploration of the sense doors today, the text leaves us with a profound question for self-reflection. It asks, do you suffer more from what is happening outside you, the sights and the sounds, or what is happening inside you with your memories and your plans?
Take a moment to really think about that the next time your internal threat sirens start going off.
And to leave you with one final thought on the mechanics of our attention, here's a quote from the psychologist Daniel Kahneman. Nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it.